Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Sponsored by Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by CyberTrust.
Hello and welcome to the 35th edition of this podcast. We have three guests on the show this week. Adam Poynton, a Chief Security Officer with an ASX-listed financial services company. We'll be chatting to him about what's on his radar as an Australian CSO. Apparently that means virtualization dramas and mobile data. We'll also hear from Thomas Frazier from our sponsor Verizon Business Security Solutions. He'll be talking about the Payment Card Industry Data Security Standard, or PCI DSS as it is better known, and how he expects to see that standard popping up in non-payment card industries. Now, normally at this point in the show, we'd hear from Munir Kataria from ZDNet Australia to discuss this week's headlines. Unfortunately, Munir is quite ill today, and believe me on that one, I spoke to him on the phone briefly earlier and he sounded, he just did not sound the best, let us say. So if you're listening, Munir, I hope you get well soon. But in his place this week, we'll be discussing the news with Adam Boileau, aka Metal Storm. Adam was a security consultant for securityassessment.com, although he's recently moved on. And these days he works as a security researcher for Dave Itell's business Immunity Inc., perhaps better known as ImmunitySec. He's also the organiser of the upcoming KiwiCon security conference being held in Wellington, and he's got some news on that front as well. I started off this week's analysis of ZDNet Australia's headlines by asking Adam what he thought of this whole Howard Hacker thing. For those of you who didn't get a chance to read the papers or online news over the last week or so, there was a huge controversy when news.com.au, a News Corporation website, reported that the website of Australian Prime Minister John Howard had been targeted by hackers. Now, apparently the website content had been modified, according to the report. A caption of our fearless leader was made to read, "I like to suck dick." I love post-production beeping, by the way. Fun. Well, it turns out that the website wasn't hacked at all. Some brainiac out there used a cross-site scripting bug he'd found in the pages code to make it look like it had been modified, assuming you could get someone to click on a specially crafted URL that would blend your new and improved caption with the site's actual content. Needless to say, we saw a flurry of reports on online news sites suggesting the website itself had been penetrated. I'm still getting pitches from public relations companies who want me to interview their so-called security experts on the hacking of campaign websites, for God's sakes. Now, the report was misleading in the extreme, but it brought the issue of cross-site scripting bugs to the fore. And as Boileau explains, they're not always trivial bugs.
Well, I think cross-site scripting is underestimated, personally. The state of the art in cross-site scripting attacks, actually genuinely using it for evil, is quite sophisticated, much more so than you would expect. Now, the majority of people only use cross-site scripting for, you know, inserting amusing comments into websites, but there's a lot more that you can do, and it's a very powerful technique for attacking client-side systems. When you see some of the tools like GNU Citizen, PDP Architect, I think his name is a guy. He writes a whole bunch of cross-site scripting tools. Some of them will allow you to proxy through the client system that you've cross-site scripted, so you can talk to their internal network through the browser cross-site scripting. Or there's also browser rootkits that can sniff your keystrokes or your form, the forms that you're filling out, your authentication credentials, and send them off. So these things are real threats, but they're real threats to the client, not real threats to the server systems which are being, used as the vector.
Yeah.
So in this case, John Howard.
That sounds like a very cool attack, under the right sort of scenario, but it's still really a low-hanging fruit sort of flaw, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly they're easy to find, but that, I don't think necessarily makes them low value. If you are in the middle of a targeted attack against somebody, then exploiting the fact that there are cross-site scripting vulnerabilities in practically every website with dynamic content that you look at, everybody uses those websites, so you can hack anybody by compromising dynamic scripted websites through cross-site scripting.
Yeah, but I mean, then you have to actually get someone to click on a specially crafted link that you forged. I mean, it's not like you can use the cross-site scripting bug to actually modify the content that resides on the server.
No, you can modify someone's view of it. But, and yeah, the interesting thing is obviously triggering it in such a way that it's transparent to the end user. And that's, you know, sort of a more social engineering sort of art form than it is a technical thing. But from a technical point of view, it's a very powerful technique. And I think, you know, underestimated just because it's primarily used in the media for pranks like this.
Okay, well, I suppose we can say that while the severity of cross-site scripting vulnerabilities is still debatable, the jury is in on the reporting by news.com.au, and it was pretty woeful.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, mate. Now, look, this is a very quick little item here, but, you know, we like to pull out these sort of odd-spot funny features here. The Indian Police Academy was yesterday notified that it was hosting a phishing site posing as the Bank of America.
Yeah, well, you know, people get hacked, and occasionally people who get hacked are amusing. But, you know, welcome to the internet, I guess. Maybe you should employ someone who's over the age of 13 to make your website.
Yeah, I remember I stumbled across a Commonwealth Bank phishing attempt that was hosted on the website of a Florida sheriff. Similar sort of story, and I actually rang them up, you know, and because they're being a sheriff's office, they were 24/7, and the girl who answered the phone did not really know what the hell I was talking about.
Yeah, well, that's not really surprising, is it?
No, but quite funny anyway. Now, I guess this is an interesting story here, and I guess one that meshes very much with anecdotal evidence that I'm sure both you and I have come across. Australian Federal Police Agent Nigel Fair, who was formerly of the Australian High Tech Crime Centre, says that Australian organisations are sweeping security breaches under the carpet to avoid public scrutiny.
Well, that certainly matches with my experience in the industry. I don't think I have ever worked on a security compromise that's been publicised, and I've worked on a bunch of them.
What about a security compromise that's been reported to the police?
In general, the only things that get reported to the police are ones where there are serious amounts of money involved in. Really, even then, what are the police going to do? I mean, I guess I've seen the police involved where there's been threats for bodily harm or suicide, and the police have actually responded quite well. Oh, yeah, so when I used to work at an internet service provider, we'd often get calls to track down the IPs of people who threatened to, you know, hurt themselves on IRC or on, you know, instant messaging clients. But really, that was about where the police stopped being effective after that.
So it looks like, you know, it is being swept under the carpet, I guess. I mean, so you're basically saying that's a fair statement.
Absolutely, yes. Really, if you phone the police, well, what do you expect them to do, right? They don't have any more computer forensics capacity than you or I. They don't have the resources to go and track down botnet farmers in Russia. What exactly do you expect the police to do when you phone them? So people, even if they wanted to phone the police, they're not going to because it's a waste of everybody's time.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that's the if that's something that everyone would agree with you on there, Adam. You know, I think that many people would say that it's just an appropriate process when there's been a theft of corporate information to contact the authorities, regardless of whether or not they can help.
Right. I definitely think that having the information available about who's been compromised and when and where and how and by whom, hopefully, that stuff would be very, very helpful. And so I think having a, you know, some sort of clearinghouse for providing that information to a, you know, some sort of government body who can produce statistics, I think that's very valuable. But in terms of prosecuting and tracking people down, I don't expect much. The important discussions that we've had lately about mandatory data breach disclosure, you know, like they have the law in California that requires you to do so. Mm. There's been discussions about a similar law in New Zealand recently.
And the same in Australia as well. I mean, do you think those laws are something that will be a positive influence?
Absolutely. I think that anything that pushes security concerns further up the corporate food chain, you know, towards the, you know, the CEOs and CFOs, is a good thing because that will encourage, you know, more responsible valuing of these incidents, like actually caring about how much money these things cost when you have to report them.
Moving on to the next item. And this is a lovely theme that we've popped up. Businesses still consider desktop users to be the biggest security risk to their networks. And I just love it. It's the attitude of the security community, which is to blame the user. Seems like that's still a well-entrenched philosophy.
Yeah, well, I agree. I guess the important point is that security and complexity really are the same thing, and desktops are by far the most complex system. So, I mean, we are giving the users systems that are filled with security flaws to use. So, you know, how can we be surprised that that's where we find a large number of vulnerabilities? So, I mean, really, I think if we want the users to cure themselves, then we have to give them better systems to do it with.
Or a pen and paper.
Yeah, or a pen and paper. Let's see you hack that from Russia.
Now, look, I mean, iPhone, another iPhone hack. There's just been a series of these stories. Oh, the iPhone's been hacked. Oh, Apple's disabled it with an update. Oh, the iPhone's been hacked. And it looks like this little to and fro is still continuing.
Yeah, well, I mean, welcome to the cable TV industry and the satellite TV industry from the 90s, right? It's an arms race. Get used to it, Apple.
Yeah, yeah, it looks that way. But I mean, you know, besides, I guess, real enthusiasts, who can really be bothered patching and, you know, depatching and patching their phone to make it work on other networks, you know?
Yeah, and given that it's such a small amount of the user base that's going to care, why do Apple bother, right? Mm. They should either accept that there are people who want to play with their kit and do things that they didn't intend to do with it and embrace them as evangelists, or they should just get the hell out of their way, because really it's, you know, it's 10 guys who want to play with their iPhones, and everyone else can pay Apple big money.
Yeah, it's a sort of form of techno-fascism, isn't it? It's like, you will use our device the way we decree you shall. Yeah, okay. And I guess this is worth mentioning, is Oracle is readying a mega update patch, fixing 51 security holes.
Yeah. Oh, when Oracle started that whole unbreakable marketing campaign back whenever the hell it was, worst idea ever. I mean, really... If I ran a big Oracle rig, I don't know if I would even bother patching it, because really it's just as rootable after as it is before. If you're an Oracle admin, move your Oracle away from the rest of your users, firewall the crap out of it, and keep everyone the hell away from it.
Just put it in a locked room with no cables coming in or out.
Really, Oracle have demonstrated, I guess, the least ability to deal with security in a responsible manner. I mean, contrasting the way Oracle do it with how Microsoft do it, I think is really, you know, it says a lot about Oracle. And I know guys who are sitting on dozens of Oracle Zero Day and who have been trying to report these things to Oracle for years, and they get absolutely no help from Oracle at all. You know, I'm not surprised that, you know, Oracle's releasing a jumbo, you know, global hyper mega patch. Yeah, I'll do another one in 6 months, and... Really, is the Oracle going to be any less rootable? No.
Yeah, well, it's surprising, though, because it doesn't seem to be really harming their business, despite the fact that they're hideously insecure.
Well, and that's because your Oracle's in the middle of your network, and if someone's in the middle of your network, they've already screwed you anyway, because they own the desktop boxes that the Oracle admins use. So it doesn't matter how patched it is, because they got the password.
I've got to admit, though, I'm quite surprised that Microsoft hasn't run any advertisements attacking the security of Oracle much in the same way that Apple ads attack the security of Microsoft products.
Yeah, but then Microsoft SQL Server hasn't had a sterling record, really, has it?
So I guess it's like, let he who is without sin cast the first stone.
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's why no one...
It's the new security mantra.
The database market.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, now, Adam, I believe you've got some news of your own relating to KiwiCon.
Yes, so we are very pleased to announce that this weekend we've finalized the list of speakers for KiwiCon 2007, and they're up on our website, kiwicon.org, and the schedule's been announced as well, so you can choose what time of the day you need to arrive to see all the interesting things. We've got a couple of interesting additions in the new round of speakers. The keynote by Peter Goodman from the University of Auckland is a world-famous cryptographer who's recently been in the press for disparaging Vista's DRM. And we also have a presentation from the New Zealand Government Communications Security Bureau, which is our sort of shadowy NSA equivalent, the very people who run the Echelon spy network in New Zealand.
The much feared New Zealand spy agency.
The much feared New Zealand spy agency, armed with their huge budget and array
of course, for the
gadget.
Responsible, of course, for the assassination of both JFK, Lumumba in the Belgian Congo. You know, every time there's been a major political assassination, I'm sure it was them.
Absolutely, yeah. And that whole Rainbow Warrior thing, an inside job, man, inside job.
Yeah, we've got to worry about New Zealand's quest for world domination. And you've got over 180 registrations, is that right?
Yeah, so the numbers, we're looking at about 160 people attending, and we've got 20-odd speakers. So, yeah, 180 people, that's quite a con, especially for New Zealand.
Yeah, not too bad. So that happens in Wellington in November. Which date's in November?
November 17 and 18, so that's just over a month away.
Okay, well, Adam Walu, thank you very much for filling in for Munir Katadia this week.
Not a problem, man. Thanks very much.
That was Adam Walu there, discussing the week's news. We'll be right back after this.
RSA is leading the fight against online fraud by providing proven solutions to protect businesses against the latest online threats. By protecting your business, your customers, their brands and assets, you can make your online channel a safer place to conduct business. To fight online fraud, visit informationriskmanagement.com.au/riskybusiness.
Our next guest, Adam Poynton, has appeared on Risky Business a couple of times before. He's been in the InfoSec game for many years now, working as a penetration tester, consultant, and researcher, and now a CSO. He's found bugs in everything from Asterisk and Cisco, but recently traded his pocket protector for a suit and tie, becoming the chief security officer of an ASX-listed financial services company based in Melbourne. He's asked me not to name the company because, well, he's completely paranoid, as all good CSOs should be. And I suppose in the interests of full disclosure, I should mention that we're old friends. I've known Adam since he spent his days terrorising the network administrators at our high school in Melbourne in the early 90s, those poor system administrators. So I started off by asking Adam what's keeping him up at night as a CSO. Apparently number one on his list is the sloppy use of VMware's virtualization technology. He's seen some scary deployments during his time as a consultant, and he's keeping an eye on his minions so they don't make the same mistakes.
A lot of people are getting on the VM bandwagon and wanting to either consolidate systems to save hardware costs and whatnot, and most of them are, from what I see, is everybody's putting them all the eggs in the same basket, and segregation just going out the window, and where you've got protected networks and public networks all running underneath the same sort of master virtual system. A lot of problems with that.
Now, you know, the guys over at VMware, I was over at their conference in LA. You know, I had a discussion with their chief scientist who said, look, you know, it's only the hypervisor's only 100,000 lines of code, and we've really focused on keeping these images secure and separate, you know, and we all thought, okay, that's a reasonable proposition. But recently we saw an absolute ton of vulnerabilities in VMware, didn't we?
That's right. Yeah, there's a few bugs there. A lot of them were related with sort of extra features like sharing between the master and the VM.
So this is more to do with the associated software, not so much the hypervisor itself.
Correct, yeah. But obviously still led to bugs that were in exploitable conditions where an attacker on a virtualized host could break out of that onto the master. So although it wasn't within those 100,000 lines of code or whatever it was,
still they could still take control of the machine.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's not good, is it?
Not at all, especially when people are putting all of their sensitive systems within a public network virtualized environment. You've got public users jumping on and they're able to get out of that environment, then they're in your high security network.
So I guess the message for chief security officers out there who might be listening is that don't assume that because you've got two images separated through a virtualization layer that, you know, that they're actually isolated.
That's right. Yeah, you still need to follow the same segregation sort of rules that you always have with network, but especially with software.
Is this a problem more to do with the guys at the coalface who are deploying the technology, or do you think it's a C-level problem that CIOs and CSOs don't fully understand the risks associated with virtualization?
Up the top, a lot of people are seeing the benefits of virtualization.
Well, this is sort of what I'm getting at. They see it as a great way to save money, so they're sort of just jumping right on in.
Definitely, and I think lower down, people are sort of seeing that they can run a whole heap of systems on one and really sort of pushing the envelope there rather than thinking, okay, these systems need to be isolated and were previously isolated from each other. So although we do have the spare cycles on the virtual machine master, let's not actually put all of them on there.
Yeah.
But they are really pushing the VM situation and running as much as they can on them.
Yeah, you've got to worry when your customer database is on the same box as your footy tipping server, don't you?
Absolutely. And, yeah. You know, if there's a thin virtualization layer separating them, whereas previously there was, you know, a couple of firewalls and some monitoring systems, then, yeah, big issue.
Okay, now another interesting theme that we've discussed prior to this interview is the convergence between the discipline of physical security and cybersecurity, particularly in the area of CCTV.
That's right, yeah.
I guess the thesis here is that because all of your CCTV, you know, camera and image traffic is running over the same network that carries data, you're really going to want to have words with the people who manage those systems for your enterprise.
That's correct, especially because usually the CCTV cameras are physically less secure and usually exposed or outside the location of the physical security perimeter. But definitely because that IP network that those cameras are on connect back to your network somewhere, so where previously it was coaxial cable or things like that. Now it's effectively under the technology area rather than security.
Now, Adam, you mentioned also that there were some new attacks that could be used to pretty much render CCTV cameras, IP-enabled CCTV cameras, quite useless.
That's right. There's been a lot of sort of bugs in the CCTV camera implementations, but just recently, I think it was just last week, a researcher released some vulnerabilities in the Axis flavored cameras. And the interesting one, or the neat feature, I guess, was you could actually hijack the video stream and send it an alternative video stream. So people that are watching through that CCTV camera will get a video of whatever you want or whatever you put towards the camera, whatever you stream to it.
So it could be a five-second loop from earlier that makes everything look okay, like in the movies.
Exactly. You know, it's like the Speed, I think it was, with Keanu Reeves, where they use that technique, and it's exactly that, but in IP land. So it's definitely an issue, especially because it can happen from anywhere. They don't need physical access to all the cameras. If they're on that network, they can potentially hijack and send an alternative video feed to all of your cameras.
And I'm sure any supervillains listening will be really pleased about that.
Oh, it's a neat trick.
Yeah, it is. I can just see them sitting there stroking their long-haired white cats, you know, just working out their next super heist. Now, I suppose before we mentioned that these cameras also often plug into the same networks, well, same cable infrastructure that are used by the networks in buildings and, you know, installations. So also it's very important to VLAN the CCTV stuff and keep it completely separate from network traffic.
That's right. Yeah, it should be at minimum VLAN and physically segregated if possible.
A lot of cable though, if you're going to physically segregate, isn't
it? It is, but if you're running new cable to replace the coax that's already there.
I remember, Adam, a couple of years ago, we were discussing a 802.11 flaw, I believe, was discovered by OSCERT, which would enable people to take out wireless CCTV cameras. And I guess, you know, it's a bit of a contradiction, isn't it, calling a wireless camera closed circuit. But are people still using wireless CCTV cameras out there?
Yeah, you definitely do see them around. I mean, when you are sort of scanning for wireless networks in a passive way, of course, you do pick up devices that identify themselves as IP cameras. And they're quite cheap these days with all the sort of little D-links and so forth on the market. So not so much in a large corporate will they be used to protect or monitor the environment, but in a small office situation, they're quite common, yes, and in the home.
And are you ready to declare wireless IP cameras as just a really bad idea in general?
It's less an ideal idea. I would definitely suggest against using them, but I would make sure that a physically wired CCTV camera was also physically segregated or VLAN isolated if that's all you can sort of set up there. You want to basically have one or several dedicated VLANs for your CCTV cameras and ideally a different VLAN for each camera. Therefore, each camera is isolated from one another. So if an attacker was to physically breach the network at that point, they wouldn't have access to the other cameras.
The other issue, of course, that you've said is really high on your agenda at the moment is the whole problem with mobile data. Now, we discussed this in the TechEd panel with Microsoft's Steve Riley a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
And it seems you're expressing similar concerns about customer records and whatnot being available, you know, on unencrypted drives on laptops.
Yeah, definitely. Laptops is a big concern because a lot of people sort of put data on there haphazardly, and although you do either encrypt some partitions or some areas of the laptop or the entire laptop in some cases, data loss through laptop or mobile device such as PDA is definitely high on my agenda. Backup security has always been an issue, but that's sort of quietened down and is resolved to a point these days. But mobile data is quite scary.
Yeah, look, it really is, isn't it? And you cited an example of the Gap clothing store losing some records.
Yeah, I think it was the biggest one that I've heard of so far, which was 800,000 people's information on one laptop.
You've got to ask what it was doing there in the first place, don't you?
Well, it was a recruitment company that had been recruiting for positions across all of North America for 18 months or so.
And we learned
quite a lot of information.
And we learned through that monster.com Trojan thing that popped up, was that in the last month or so, that, you know, resumes are a real target for the bad guys.
Yeah, because everybody wants to put as much info on the resume as they can, and it's got a lot of history as well, a lot of current information. So it's a prize for the attackers out there.
Now, where do you think the solution lies? Do you think it lies in controlling what goes onto the laptops, or do you think it involves, you know, technologies like Microsoft's BitLocker and full disk encryption stuff?
I think any layer of those is a bare minimum. I think full disk encryption is the go if it's possible. Of course, you can't always get full disk encryption for PDAs and other mobile devices, and there is an overhead. But
that translates to a loss in battery time, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Failing that, it is always sort of impossible to control exactly what data goes where. But if you've got multiple layers, it's the old defense in depth. In-depth strategy, encrypt the data, encrypt the laptop, you know, keys and everything.
That was Melbourne-based CSO Adam Poynton there with a rundown on what makes him very, very nervous. It's time for this week's sponsor interview. This podcast would not be possible without the support of Verizon Business Security Solutions. So each week we have one of the company's representatives on the show to discuss a theme or trend. This week, we're chatting with Thomas Frazier, Verizon Business Security Solutions Security Portfolio Manager. Thomas, I guess the first question I really want to ask you is your opinion on the success of PCI DSS, because I've heard a lot of conflicting accounts. Some people say, you know, it's really given organizations the kick up the butt that they've needed to implement some decent security programs. And other people have said that, you know, compliance is a joke.
That's a good question. I mean, it really boils down to what do you consider a success? You know, when you compare PCI to government-type standards, I think it's been a huge success. They've taken, in a relatively short amount of time, they've taken a good standard that's primarily good security motherhood statements and made some real working out of it. So, you know, I think it's been quite effective. And we've yet to see a fully compliant merchant have a... or disclose a breach.
But are we yet to see a fully compliant merchant?
Yeah, I mean, the worldwide there are a number of fully compliant merchants. September was a big month for the Americas, is when all the level ones had to be compliant.
But isn't one of the problems, I suppose, in Australia is that for most merchants, really they do their own evaluations on whether they're compliant or not?
That's primarily driven by the banks that are their acquiring banks. So we have seen a lot of merchants and service providers that need to be evaluated more than once in order to achieve compliance. But that primarily boils down to, I mean, depends on the merchant or service provider, but more around the documentation and applications more than the actual being compliant with what's required.
Now, I understand it's your position, Tom, that the PCI DSS is a standard that is, I suppose, easy and user-friendly enough to see it spread into parts of industry which don't actually use credit card data, which was what the standard was designed for.
Yeah, I mean, if you really break down the requirements of PCI, there's only a handful of requirements that are specific around credit card data. What PCI has done very effectively is introduce a standard that is applicable for all areas of IT security. So, you know, you look at some other industries, you know, SCADA right now, environments that have, or organizations that have SCADA environments, they're really going through a renaissance of reinventing their network and application systems to modernize them with, you know, IP access to these major SCADA systems. I mean, there's no reason why PCI, minus the credit card aspects, wouldn't be a great baseline for SCADA.
But don't we already have standards like that, like 7799 and, you know, the government standard ACSI 33? Why would anyone actually use this standard, which has really been created for credit card merchants?
Well, I mean, 7799 is a great standard, and I guess it's very comprehensive. So it details every type of control and all the different types of environments, as well as the, I guess, plan, do, check, act model of how to properly manage that over time. The problem with larger standards like that, I mean, they're much more difficult to implement. So while the detail is there and they're very comprehensive, you know, the cost of actually doing that type of activity is much greater.
What is it that specifically that's so good about PCI, do you think?
Well, I think PCI, you know, if we take a step back and look, why was PCI created? And just as an example, the Federal Trade Commission in the U.S. published some information in January of this year stating that 25% of all the ID theft in 2006 was related to credit cards.
Mm.
Right. So that really shows that there was a major problem in the industry. And there were Visa, MasterCard, JCB, Diners, American Express. You know, they all had their own internal programs to try to achieve the same outcome. And they just weren't being effective. And they weren't being effective primarily because the banks didn't want all of these different standards to interact with. And the merchant and service providers just had no clue as to how you do this for one merchant or one card membership versus another. So PCI, I think, has been really effective at doing that, that they've consolidated all of these into one program that they'll all endorse.
Mm.
And it's simplified it for everybody. So, I mean, that type of model is something that, you know, other industries could really learn from, about how to simplify things and really boil it down to, you know, what are the key security concerns and how do you implement them?
Can you think of an example where PCI has been used in a non-merchant business?
I don't know of an organization specifically that is using PCI as their primary security guide for their entire organization. But, I mean, it is something that if you look at some of the, I guess, key consultants around PCI, you know, we are seeing, a lot of activity around how PCI is applicable. And I think that's a precursor to really understanding how these motherhood statements can be implemented for non-credit card environments.
So when would you expect to see some action, or maybe would you even expect to see a modified PCI standard creeping out there for non-payment card industry organizations?
Well, I wouldn't even leverage the term PCI, because PCI is payment card industry, but the idea that the industry has identified a problem, huge credit card theft, and they've implemented a very fundamental security program and given some time and dates as to when those need to be implemented. I mean, that's something that a number of industries have tried through government-endorsed programs, and they have had slower adoption rates. And, you know, I think we're at a point now where it comes down to where is the pain, and when the pain threshold is really high, we'll start to see industries do similar to what the credit card industry has done.
Well, I guess the price of non-compliance in the case of PCI is, you know, really going to hit companies' bottom lines if their merchant facilities are taken away from them, aren't they? I mean, that's a hell of a motivation.
Yeah, I mean, if at this point you're not PCI compliant and you do have a breach, it is possible that you will go out of business completely. And there are several examples that have been in the press around that. And, you know, I don't think that's a scare tactic. I think that's a matter of fact.
Okay, well, it looks like PCI could be on the move. Thomas Fraser, thank you very much for joining us this week.
Thanks a bunch.
That's it for another edition of Risky Business. I hope you'll join us again soon. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast via iTunes or email alerts, which you can find on the itradio.com.au website. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. These questions keep asking with persistence. It's hard to figure what's the truth. Well, now my perception of you from a distance has never been so beautiful. And if perception is all about resistance, well, then you give me something to look up to. And something at first, I didn't expect the worst. And now you show me the first. Intentions met with your resistance. What if I held on to you? And all these questions keep asking with persistence. It's hard to figure what's the truth. Well, my perception of you from a distance has never been so beautiful. And if perception is all about resistance, you give me something to look up to. Sap it at first, you didn't expect the worst. And now you show me the worst. What's a beautiful butter? And I couldn't find the words you needed to be heard. No,
Yeah.